KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. The primary election is August 6th. Ballots are on their way to the voters. Coming up on Weekday, we'll kick off 3 days of conversation with Seattle's 9 mayoral candidates. Today, State Senator Ed Murray and librarian and activist Joey Gray. Meanwhile, the U.S. Senate is heading for a showdown over filibusters, and that may seem arcade, but in recent years, filibusters, or the threat of a filibuster, have blocked numerous bills in Congress. We're joined once again by CBS News Capitol Hill producer Jill Jackson. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Marcy.
Well, let's talk about the filibuster. What exactly are senators going to be meeting about today?
Well, it's going to be a last-minute attempt to reach a compromise and avoid what is called the nuclear option. Now, Majority Leader Harry Reid threatened last week to use the nuclear option and actually go for it. That would mean that basically Reid would change the Senate's rules and allow votes on executive branch nominations to be approved with a simple majority vote. Now, currently, you typically need 60 votes for executive branch nominees, and it gives the minority party, in this case Republicans, a lot of power to delay and make demands of the administration before they give them enough numbers to actually end the filibuster and vote on that executive branch nominee. So if they're unable to reach a compromise, then Reid plans tomorrow to go ahead and bring up some of the controversial executive branch nominations that Republicans have been blocking. And when the Republicans attempt to block those nominations, Reid would essentially say it just needs a simple majority. He would try to change the rules, which would allow them to move forward with just a simple majority vote. Now, the parliamentarian would almost assuredly object, because to change the Senate's rules, you need 67 votes, something that the Democrats do not have. But Reid can overrule the parliamentarian. So it's a lot of complicated parliamentary juggernaut that's going on, but it's very critically important to the way the Senate works.
Well, let me just take a step back, because I think when we hear the word filibuster, we think of what took place on the floor of the Texas legislature a couple weeks ago, where the state representative Wendy Davis stood for 12 or so hours and tried to prevent a vote on a restrictive abortion bill. Filibuster in Congress these days means not having 60 votes, right?
That's exactly correct, and it's used all the time. I mean, the Republicans filibuster, and the Democrats did too when they were in the minority. They would filibuster on everything from just, you know, filibuster even bringing up a bill to filibuster, you know, ending debate on a bill. And all they need is the 60 votes, and that's because the rules changed decades ago because they wanted to give the minority a little bit more power, and they also wanted to avoid legislation being held up for a very long period of time by the true filibusters. It was supposed to be a way to make things more efficient, but it truly has resulted in a lot more gridlock in the Senate now.
So essentially what's not at stake so much is what kind of executive appointments come up, but really how they do business.
Exactly. And what we'll see tonight is the senators will meet in the old Senate chamber, which is just a few doors down from the current Senate chamber. It is where the Senate met from 1819 until 1859. It's this gold and crimson room that's very ornate and beautiful. It was later the actual room where the Supreme Court met until 1935, which a lot of people forget that the Supreme Court actually met in the Congress. It's a very historic room. There are only 64 senators' desks in there, so I'm kind of curious how
standing room only
left out in terms of a formal desk. But it's going to be a critical meeting where both sides say that they hope some sort of last-minute deal can be reached. similar to a deal that was reached in 2005 when we were on the brink of this exact same same nuclear option. Of course, in that, in 2005, a gang of 14 senators emerged and formed an agreement that they would not filibuster nominees. It was judicial nominees mainly that they were talking about at the time. They would only do that in the presence of an extraordinary circumstance that has broken down in recent years, that agreement. And at the moment, there's no sign of any sort of gang emerging. So this session tonight will be very important.
We're talking with Capitol Hill, CBS News Capitol Hill producer Jill Jackson. Well, let's go from something theoretical to something pretty substantial. Last week, the House decided that it was going to separate the farm bill, which it had defeated earlier this summer, from the food stamp program, something that has been an integral part of it for 30-some years. Why, first of all, why did the House take that action?
Well, because their original attempt to pass the agricultural reform bill with the food stamps in it failed. And in that case, you had 62 Republicans who voted against the bill. In the bill that they took up last week without food stamps, you only had 12 Republicans who voted against the bill. It was able to pass. It was less embarrassing than the previous vote had been for GOP leadership. They're trying to find some way to move forward, and Majority Leader Eric Cantor said last week that leadership and members of the Agriculture Committee are talking now about the way forward for some sort of food stamp bill. Now, the bill that had been brought up was controversial among Democrats and some Republicans, but to Democrats mainly because it cut $20 billion in funding for nutrition programs for the poor. They thought that was too extreme, and then at the last minute there was an amendment that was added and approved that would require would allow states to require that you show proof that you are working or that you are looking for work when you get your food stamps or when you apply for food stamps. That's something that the Democrats truly thought was too much. A lot of them who had said they would vote for the bill ended up not voting for it, and then you had the 62 Republicans who didn't want to vote for any sort of funding for the food stamp programs, or they wanted more cuts to the food stamp programs at least, and then some who are just uncomfortable with a lot of programs in the ag bill to begin with.
So at this point, the future of food stamps, it's not that there's a total opposition to a food stamp program, it's just how that program would look.
Exactly. Although there is definitely some opposition to the programs as they stand today. So I think the House Republicans would want significant reforms greater than what was in the original bill. The Senate passed a bipartisan bill on their end, and they are basically just waiting for the House to figure out what it's going to do on food stamps so that the two chambers can go to conference and work out some sort of deal and pass something, because the last time the agriculture bill was up, the two chambers were unable to reach agreement. So a lot of reforms to both the subsidy programs for farmers, a lot of programs that are outdated or need reforms are not being updated because they've been doing just a straight extension of the bill rather than reaching some sort of agreement.
And they're trying to get this done before they recess in August, right?
Actually, I spoke with an aide to Leader Cantor this morning, and he told me that this month is so busy with appropriations bills. They're so focused on Obamacare votes this week, which we'll, I'm sure,
yes,
talk about
in just a second.
That they don't know that there will be time to address the food stamps issue before the August recess. It may be something they need to do in the fall. Now, that, to me, is a major red flag, because in the fall they're going to be quite busy with the debt ceiling, with bills to keep the government open and operating.
Wow.
And then also, you know, they're going to be attempting immigration reform as well in some form or other.
And we'll be talking about that later as the fall progresses. But let us talk about health care reform. The House is voting on delays to both the employer and individual mandates this week.
That's right. So when the Obama administration decided to announce that they were going to delay the employer mandate for 1 year, the Republicans pounced, saying, "This, you know, it's not just unworkable for employers, it's unworkable for everyone, and it's not fair for..." last week, the Republicans were saying this a lot, that it's not fair for big business to get a one-year delay while someone who's working and struggling to make ends meet does not get a delay on the individual mandate. So the House on Wednesday will vote to delay both the employer mandate and the individual mandate, and they feel that they have a winning sort of populist even message, and they'll put Democrats on the record voting either with or against the president on the employer delay, and then also for or against their own implementation timeline that they passed in the health care bill. And they also want to put the Democrats on the spot by forcing them to vote on that individual mandate.
Well, you know, the House, as I understand it, has voted several dozen times to kill Obamacare outright. Is this another way to try to do that?
It is. They'll take, you know, they've voted on outright repeal, full repeal, partial repeal. Certain programs have actually been successfully overturned. They've actually voted 37 times to repeal all or part of the health care law. Now, this would be sort of it's not exactly a repeal, it's a delay, but it still would be a major change to the law. So I would definitely count this as 38. So they're nearing 40 in their major votes against Obamacare. It's something that I think is interesting to watch, because as implementation continues, it seems that while it clearly some mistakes are going to be made as implementation happens, there are going to be unexpected stumbling blocks and difficulties. And I think while it would be in some ways more constructive for Congress to work with the administration on implementation, since it is the law, and try to make implementation more smooth and effective, there's still so much opposition to the health care law. It's really not going away. And so I think we're just going to continue to see this outright opposition rather than any kind of engagement.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us this morning.
Thank you.
Jill Jackson, Capitol Hill producer for CBS News and a frequent guest here on Weekday on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silverman.
Nineteen minutes past 9 o'clock. An interview with Seattle mayoral candidate Ed Murray in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from University Bookstore. Author Terry Brooks will discuss and read from Witch Wraith, The Dark Legacy of Shannara from Random House, the final volume in the trilogy, Monday, July 15th at 7 p.m. at U Bookstore on the Ave. More information at ubookstore.com.
67 degrees in Seattle. It is sunny, and the forecast says it's going to stay sunny all day with a high of 81. Tomorrow, sunny again, getting up to 87. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:20. Joe Robinson is a journalist and author who's been investigating how we can restore vital nutrients to the foods we eat. Her conclusion? Eat on the wild side. Joe Robinson joins us in 20 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. August 6th is Election Day. Seattle voters will choose between 9 different mayoral candidates who will appear on the primary ballot. State Senator Ed Murray has represented Seattle's 43rd legislative district since 1995. He served in the State House until 2006 when he moved on to the Senate. Ed Murray and his partner of 21 years live on Seattle's Capitol Hill. We're asking each of 9 candidates a series of set questions. We're happy to have you here, by the way.
Thank you.
You're the first. So let's just start right out. The Department of Justice has a consent agreement to undertake steps to curtail unconstitutional use of excessive force by the Seattle Police Department. Federal judge is monitoring Seattle's progress. What do you think of the steps that have been taken by the city so far to fix the problem?
Well, I think the problem is an example of the problem we've had in the city for the last 4 years. Early on, the Justice Department came to us to deal with the issue of biased policing and issues of force. And instead of working collaboratively, the mayor chose to fight the Department of Justice, the Obama Democratic Department of Justice, Jenny Durkin in the U.S. Attorney's Office, as well as the city attorney's office. I think that the consent decree is actually an appalling thing for a northern city on the West Coast. I think New Orleans is the other place that has a consent decree. So this hasn't been a win for us. And to move forward, we're going to need a new mayor who can recruit the police chief that we need. If we want a really good pool of candidates, we're going to need a new mayor to get that really good pool of candidates so that we can really get down to the reforms and work with the Justice Department and hopefully move from underneath this consent decree at a much rapid pace.
So are you saying that we haven't made enough progress on the reform so far?
I think some progress has been made, but I think we have a significant way to go.
Would you replace the interim police chief?
So I would have a hiring process, a nationwide hiring process, including Seattle could apply, you know, police in Seattle could apply. But we need to go through a hiring process to identify that individual, he or she, who has the ability to reform a police department and restore the confidence of the citizens in the police department.
On to another topic. There are plans for coal terminals in Washington state to handle the coal from Wyoming bound for China and other Asian countries. Many environmentalists oppose these new coal terminals, and some union workers have said that they're in favor. What about you?
So I'm opposed to the trains and the movement of coal through our region. There's just environmental issues. There's congestion issues. But I also think that this is one of those issues where we can't do what we've done for the last 4 years in Seattle, and that's get in another confrontational situation. Labor and environmentalists have been allies, particularly in Olympia, on a series of issues. This requires a mayor who has the collaborative skills to work with them and work with jurisdictions across the state to make this happen. It's one thing to say we formed a coalition to oppose the coal trains. It's another to get the partners at the table to work through this issue and stop those coal trains.
Recently, Mayor McGinn and the Seattle City Council decided that it would shut down the homeless camp, which has been known as Nicholsville. They were going to shut it down for good and try to find permanent housing for the residents. First, do you think that was the right decision? Yes or no?
Yes, although I think you have to phase out the closure.
And more generally, how do you think the city should address the problem of homelessness?
Well, I think the partnership that we have been able to build in Olympia with the Housing Trust Fund, the dollars that go into creating low-income housing, is something that we can build on. I think identifying those individuals who need services and getting them the services they need, addiction otherwise, is one of the ways we can address it. I also think that we need to partner with the county. Because not every homeless person who leaves Harborview or the jail and ends up on the streets is from Seattle. And services, I think, also need to be located back in the communities that the people come from. I think that will actually help them stay in place longer and help to reduce the issue of homelessness. Finally, I think that the 10-year plan on homelessness was a bit late in addressing the issue of homeless youth. They're making progress on that, but I think that the city can play a significant role. You get people when they're young. You stop that kind of learned behavior early on. You prevent it later on.
And that 10-year plan was at the county level. That was
right.
King County's plan.
But the city participated in it.
You have worked for many years on the issue of transportation. Mm-hmm. How do you think Seattle can improve its transportation system?
Well, I think the thing that we lack, you know, there's a transportation plan and a transit plan, and the bike plan is being redone. Seattle lacks what a lot of cities and metropolitan regions are doing, and that is an integrated strategic transportation plan that actually prioritizes what we want to do and identifies how we're going to pay for it, that looks at how we're going to connect our various neighborhoods. I think as people look at growth, their concern is not so much simply the issue of is their neighborhood going to be negatively impacted? I think it is also an issue of are they going to be able to move in and out of their neighborhood? And what we've seen in the last 4 years are basic things such as our infrastructure and our streets and roads grow to a $2 billion backlog. And I think that, again, is an example of a lack of integration, a lack of strategic planning, and a lack of prioritization, the failure to choose what we're going to do first and what we're going to pay for first. And whether you walk on the sidewalk, ride your bicycle, or drive on the street, you know the infrastructure is crumbling. We can do better.
So when you look at this and you say there's not an agreement what we should do first, in your mind, what should we be doing first, fixing the infrastructure?
Well, I think you have to do basics, but I also think you have to – this is Seattle. I think you have to engage in a process with the council and with the citizens to put that plan together, to get people behind it. Part of leadership is bringing people along. So we would have to do that. But I don't think that we have taken our transportation planning to the next level.
It is hard in the city to separate neighborhood development, I guess just urban planning from transportation planning. There have been a number of neighborhoods that have been upzoned, meaning that more density has been targeted for those neighborhoods. Sometimes the neighborhoods are great with that, sometimes they aren't. How do you view the integration of transportation planning and where we put density?
Well, first of all, I think by identifying areas that we can grow, areas where we can put density, we can preserve the traditional character of our single family neighborhoods. I actually think it helps them. I think though the missing piece here is transportation. It's you can't put the density unless you have the transit and pedestrian and bicycle infrastructure in place. To handle it, not just to handle it in that neighborhood, but to handle it between neighborhoods. So the two need to be connected. You can't squeeze cars out unless you give people an alternative. I happen to live in the center of the city, and I have great bus service. That's not true throughout the city.
What role, you mentioned, you know, citizen, you know, opening up for discussion, but what role do neighborhood groups have in that, both that transit planning and the development?
Well, I think significantly, and I think there's, when it comes to the neighborhoods, there's several things we can do. One is, I think going back to some of the levels of the neighborhood granting to allow neighborhoods to decide how to spend money in their own neighborhood is one of the things we can do. I also think that we need to use some of the best practices around the country that's using technology and social media to bring people in who can't go to a neighborhood meeting one night a week or one night a month to get their input. I've actually started to do telephone town halls versus actual town halls as a legislator, and you have a very different discussion when the people who can't show up to a meeting show up virtually. I think there's some really exciting ways to involve citizens that we're not yet doing in the city.
We're talking with State Senator Ed Murray. He's one of nine candidates for Seattle mayor, and we'll be speaking to each of the candidates this week on Weekday and The Conversation here on KUOW. You have stressed in your campaign literature and in the many forums that you've participated in this summer that your experience in the legislature is a qualification for this job. How does being one of a group of lawmakers prepare you to be an administrator?
Sure. First of all, I've chaired all three budget committees, and I've written budgets that are larger than the city of Seattle's budget. Also, I think, you know, both locally and nationally, we've seen people leave the legislature and go into local government. Gary Locke left the state house and went into the county execs. The late Booth Gardner left the state Senate and went into the Pierce County Executive. I think what happens is we have to work in a fairly contentious environment. We have to learn to compromise with people geographically, party-wise, ideology, to come up with the successes that we want to come up with. And I think that skill set makes you prepare to be an executive in a political environment. I also think experience matters. I think experience in any level of government matters. And I think my 18 years working as a legislator, working with many cities, not just Seattle, working with our federal delegation, has given me that experience to be the next mayor of Seattle.
Here's your freebie. What do you think of the job that Mayor McGinn is doing?
Well, people said this is an issue of style, and I think it's an issue of governance. I would not be able to have passed a transportation package that restored transit funding and restored things like commute trip reduction if I wasn't able to build collaborative relationships across the state. I wouldn't have been able to pass a marriage equality bill along with my colleagues if I hadn't been able to reach out across the aisle and across some significant ideological differences. The mayor's approach has been confrontational with the state when it came to transportation. It's been confrontational with the Justice Department and the city attorney's office. So I don't believe that's the sort of leadership that Seattle needs. I actually think Seattle's looking for somebody who will, it may sound trite, but who will work to bring us together, who will show the rest of the state that progressives can actually come together and get things done, and not simply fight with each other about who is the most progressive person.
Well, you walked right into my next question. commentators and observers have called this a kind of, earlier in the summer, sort of a mushy election, because this is a race where almost every candidate stands for a similar set of progressive values. So that said, you've just talked about your style of governance, but what other reasons would distinguish, what else distinguishes you from the pack?
Well, so first of all, again, I would go back to what I said, experience. I believe the experience I have as a legislator has prepared me to be mayor. I've learned over time that you have to develop a long-term strategy. You have to be prepared to lose. You know, I lost on the civil rights bill for 10 years before I finally won. I lost 16 years on marriage before we finally won marriage. It took several years to get transportation packages through. In each of those cases, I had to develop strategies that would see me through the long term. I think that distinguishes me. I think that the breadth and depth of connections I have across the region, across the state, in state government, at the federal level, distinguishes me. And I think a proven record of having worked on some really, really, really difficult issues that people didn't think could happen, such as passing a 14.5-cent gas tax or passing marriage equality. I think those are the things that distinguished me.
You mentioned your long experience in the legislature. This was not a successful session necessarily for you and your fellow Democrats, but also not successful for Seattle itself. From our vantage point, there's a lot of, it seems that a lot of the rest of the state pushes back when Seattle lawmakers come to Olympia with things such as allowing the county to vote on its own tax hike to fund Metro Transit. So leaving Olympia and putting you, if you were elected and were then going hat in hand to deal with folks who already have a lot of animosity towards the role that this city plays, what do you, with the legislative experience, bring to that role?
Well, a few things. First of all, I think in many ways it was a very successful session for Democrats. Obamacare was passed, Medicaid expansion, 300,000 Washingtonians will have health care in 2014. The health care exchange, that again enacts Obamacare, was established. We restored programs that Seattleites care deeply about, such as adult dental health. I could go on, but to get the heart of your question, I would actually do something that I've never experienced in my 18 years as a legislator. I would actually work with the Seattle delegation to build a Seattle legislative agenda jointly versus just presenting something to them, which is what happens to us that we actually aren't involved in. I think that's how you make a difference in Seattle, I mean, in Olympia. I also think a mayor who knows Olympia and knows that you can't go down there with sort of a superior attitude, and that's been a problem with several mayors, is something that I could make a difference on.
So lastly, why do you want this job?
Well, you know, through my political career, I've generally worked on very difficult things that people said wouldn't work or wouldn't happen. And I've had a wonderful time representing the 43rd district in the legislature. I'm up for the next challenge. I really do want to build that police force that is the model for the rest of the nation about how you do urban policing. I really do want to do a far different approach to our school district and have the city and the school district develop a brand new partnership that really does change our graduation rates and the people will come to this city and show us, and we will show them how you can do urban education. There's just a whole series of exciting opportunities. This is a very, very innovative city, and I want our city government to be as innovative as the people here. I think there are great opportunities to bring people together and not to fight with people in Seattle.
State Senator Ed Murray is one of nine candidates for the mayor of Seattle. The election, we can't even say it. Election day is August 6th. That means your ballot needs to be in by August 6th. It's not really an election day anymore. You should see those ballots start to arrive this week. You're going to hear from all nine mayoral candidates this week on Weekday and the Conversation. And these interviews are going to be archived at our website, kuow.org. Ed Murray, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks so much for having me in.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
The advantages of turning your diet to the wild side in a minute.
Next time on The World, growing farm crops with human waste. It's being done safely in India.
Every person is actually a moving fertilizer unit.
A moving fertilizer unit? That's an old idea. Now with modern safeguards, it recycles human waste and reduces dependence on chemical fertilizers. Our story from India, next time on The World.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which airs from 3 to 8 p.m.
Evening tours of KUOW's broadcast facility are now available to listeners ages 15 and older. This month's evening tour is Thursday, July 18th at 6:15 p.m. Space is limited. To schedule a tour, call 206-543-2710 or email tours@kuow.org.
67 degrees and sunny in Seattle. Expect sun all day with an afternoon high of 81. Overnight, a clear sky, a low of 58, and tomorrow, Tuesday, sunny again. Breezy as well with a high of 87. Looks like plenty of sun over the course of the coming week and into the weekend, at least by afternoon. Mostly sunny all the way through. I'm Bernard Ouellette. We're going to be talking with all of the candidates for Seattle mayor over the next few days, and our very next interview will be with mayoral candidate Joey Gray 25 minutes from now.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. We hear a lot about what we're supposed to eat and what we're not supposed to eat, to stay healthy, to lose weight, to fight disease. But the advice veers wildly from go on the paleo diet, eat low fat, don't eat carbs. Well, you can just make a list yourself. Vashon Island resident Joe Robinson says perhaps we should take a step back and look at the foods that nourished our ancestors before there were such things as freeze-dried foods or processed foods. Joe Robinson's new book is called Eating on the Wild Side, and she joins me in the studio. It's great to have you here. And your book got me thinking to a mantra that I personally have been using. A few years ago, journalist Michael Pollan issued some advice, eat real food, mostly plants and things that have under five ingredients,
right,
that your grandmother would recognize.
Yeah.
And I wonder, first of all, if that mantra was just sort of too simplistic or what you thought when you heard something like that.
Well, it was meant to be simple and memorable, and it is. But I actually find that that particular message doesn't jibe with the new science. Turns out that what our grandparents ate and our great grandparents ate was not as nutritious as the food we used to eat before we were farmers. And so I'm saying, let's not go back one or two generations. Let's go back 400 generations and see what we ate when we were foraging for wild plants, and then what are the nutrients in there? What do we know about how they benefit us? And how we can reclaim those nutrients today.
One of the things that you start with is sort of how our contemporary tastes, what we Americans, but actually probably all people on the planet,
right,
what we find tasty. And it's not necessarily what early humans found tastier because it probably didn't exist. But how did our taste buds evolve?
Yeah, so that's it's really the root of all of our problems. Our whole appreciation of flavors and the chemicals that we get when we eat certain flavors, that's all designed to keep us, to help us survive and thrive in the wilderness, where, just as you mentioned, where fat, sugar, and salt are very rare. But we needed a lot of calories because we had a very energetic lifestyle. So we were programmed to seek out things that were high in starch, high in sugar, high in fat, so that we would have enough to survive. And we have those very same inclinations today, and they're powerful inclinations. When we eat fat and sugar, it's not just our taste buds that tingle, but there's messages sent to the brain that release these feel-good chemicals. So that's why we have so much desire for these things. But the problem is not our taste buds. It's the fact that we've created a whole new food supply designed around those things that we love to eat.
And you're not talking just about potato chips and French fries and candy bars. You're talking about actual fruits and vegetables.
Right.
What kinds of tastes we bred into our plant life.
That's right. So as an example, there's some wild apples that have 100 times more of these antioxidants than the Golden Delicious, which is our most popular apple. Well, this recent study, men at high risk for cardiovascular disease, for heart attack and stroke, were given one Golden Delicious apple a day for 2 months. And the theory was that they were going to reduce their risk of these things. And it turned out that the opposite was true, that this apple is so sweet and so low in antioxidants, because we've bred it out of them, that they had higher of the blood fats that you know, were putting them at risk for these deadly diseases.
Now, that's something that really stopped me in my tracks as I was reading, because not only do we hear an apple a day keeps the doctor away, but really what we're supposed to be saying is a certain kind of apple a day keeps the doctor away. And it's not just a bag of baby carrots from the grocery store that are going to help you. I'm assuming, maybe perhaps wrongly, that a bag of baby carrots is better than a bag of M&Ms.
Yes. Yes. Well,
if I had my choice between those two.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And, you know, like you say, it's, you know, eat a lot of fruits and vegetables. That's the bottom line. But if you're looking for optimum health, or you're fighting disease, or you have a high risk for disease like I do, there's a lot of cancer in my family, I'm going to do what I can do, make these choices that are going to give me more defense against disease. And I want to live long and healthy. So I'm not going to eat any fruit or vegetable. I'm going to eat certain ones.
We're talking with Joe Robinson, whose book is called Eating on the Wild Side. And this is not about foraging. This is about finding food that most resembles those foods that our 400 generations ago ancestors ate.
That's right. So what I did was I spent 10 years. I read over 6,000 studies. And what I was looking for was modern-day varieties that we can find in the supermarket or the farmer's market or a seed catalog that bring back those nutrients we've bred out of our food but taste great.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're not going to go back and eat wild food. It's bitter, it's chewy, it's hairy. We're not going to do that. So we need to have something that we love to eat but is more nutritious.
I just have to take a little bit of a sideways route here for a second, because it's the bitterness. The reason the bitterness was actually a protective thing.
That's right.
So there's a reason that the bitter is good for us.
We would not be here if we did not have a strong reaction to things that are intensely bitter, because many things that are intensely bitter can kill us. So we had to have this built-in rejection of bitterness, but we've taken it way too far, especially in this country, where so many of our fruits and vegetables are bland to the point of ridiculousness.
Well, let's talk about another thing that I have heard, and I don't remember where, which is that if I'm looking at a nutritious plate, it should have a lot of colors of vegetables.
Right.
Mostly vegetables, and they should be green and leafy and orange and, you know,
right.
I should be looking for a pretty plate with,
right.
you know, artistically
yeah.
aesthetic. Is there any truth to that?
Well, first of all, there's more antioxidants in fruits than in vegetables.
Really?
Far more.
Wow.
And in terms of color, yes, those bold colors are an indication that it has certain nutrients in it. But many of these antioxidants, a broader term for that is phytonutrients, plant compounds, are colorless. So as an example, a peach or nectarine that has white flesh is more nutritious than those that have golden flesh. It breaks the rules. But you would have to eat 6 golden-fleshed peaches to get the protection, the health benefits of 1 white peach. Sounds crazy, but this is what the new science is telling us.
We also hear about things like blueberries, for example,
yeah.
you know, miracle fruit. I eat about a cup of blueberries right now because I can find fresh ones. But blueberry is one of those fruits that sort of also belies eat fresh because you were saying that processed blueberries actually have more phytonutrients for us than the fresh ones.
It is true that berries
which was very depressing.
Get better for us when they're cooked. But I mean, that means tarts and pies and cobblers.
Oh, really?
You know?
So a pie is healthy.
But it's maybe 50% better for us. And but the berries themselves fresh are excellent foods.
Oh, okay. So
yes.
All berries.
All berries.
Why?
Well, first of all, berries are really high in fiber, which we don't think about because they're so soft. But they have more fiber, you know, ounce per ounce than bran cereal. So they're great. They're really wonderful in fiber, high in vitamin C. But they're especially rich in these antioxidants, the ones that are purple and blue and red, that are proving to be most advantageous to our health. So if people do nothing more than eat more berries, they're going to really reduce the risk of some serious diseases.
Well, I mean, that's great. You and I are speaking in July, so we have berries galore. But oftentimes in the middle of December, you're looking at the freezer section.
Right.
Does freezing fruit, for example, kill the nutrients, or can I buy a bag of frozen blueberries and strawberries and raspberries in the winter?
You can buy a bag because the new technology, the flash freezing, does not damage the texture or the nutrients as much. The problem comes when you thaw it.
Oh. Oh, no.
Yes.
So I should eat them frozen.
Yes, it might freeze your throat. No. What the problem is that if you thaw berries in the refrigerator or on the counter, all that time they're thawing, the phytonutrients are being destroyed by an enzyme.
Oh, no.
Yes.
So
half of them will go away.
Wow. Should I cook them? Will that help?
If you cook them right away, that works. But here's craziness again. The best thing to do about berries is defrost them in the microwave. Because it takes 10 minutes instead of 4 hours or 8 hours. Huh. So that enzyme that's breaking down those good things has less time to act. So, you know, flash, freeze, flash, thaw.
Okay, I can remember that rule. Joe Robinson is with us. The other, it's not startling, but it was startling to me, a piece of information was that I should cook a whole carrot. And that if I cooked my carrot, it was going to make those nutrients more available than if I took the beautiful carrot that I got from my farm box last
right.
week, peeled it, and ate it.
Absolutely. First of all, when you peel a carrot, so you've got a stack of peels over here and you've got the rest of the carrot over there, the peels would give you as many nutrients as that whole carrot.
Wow, so I should wash the carrot.
Just scrub that carrot.
Okay.
And if you cook it, you get about twice as much beta carotene. If you eat it with oil, like butter or extra virgin olive oil, you get even more. And if you cook it whole, you get the most. But also, if you cook it whole, it tastes sweeter. So there's a lot of benefits.
Is there a certain way I should cook a carrot? I mean,
Yes, don't boil it.
Well, that seemed to be true for most
yes,
of the vegetables.
Uh-huh.
Like, don't throw things right. in big pots of water.
Right, exactly.
Steam it? Steaming?
Steam it or microwave.
Hmm. So how do you use microwave for most of the cooking of fruits and vegetables?
Actually, I also do a lot of sautéing in extra virgin olive oil because the nutrients that want to leak out to water, and if there's no water, then it won't do that. And it actually becomes more nutritious when you like sauté it in olive oil because it absorbs the phytonutrients in the oil. So I do a lot of sautéing and steaming.
Another question I had to do with another of the many food fads that I alluded to in introducing you, which is raw food.
Right.
Raw foodists, I think that is the term, maintain that because they're not cooking out the nutrients, that what they're doing is eating a healthier diet. And that's not always necessarily true when it comes to at least some of the fruits and vegetables that you write about.
I would say the majority of fruits and vegetables are better for us cooked than raw.
Really?
Uh-huh. Because the cell membranes break down and soften, and when we eat them, all of those nutrients inside those cells we can absorb them. And we've been cooking our food for 500,000 years. This is not a modern invention. I mean, we ate raw food when we were, you know, our cousins, our ape and chimpanzee cousins, lived on raw food. But we really, it's advantageous to us to cook many things.
I know that this book is pretty much about fruits and vegetables, but what about things like modern grains or even some of the heirloom grains that are being introduced? Should we focus primarily on fruits and vegetables in terms of eating for disease prevention?
Yes. there are varieties of these grains that are better for us than others. And, their whole grains are fine. They do have health benefits, but not as many as fruits and vegetables. And we didn't eat grain when we were running around in the woods, before we were gardeners living on wild food. We did not eat many grains. It's not bad for you unless you're intolerant to gluten. Mm-hmm. Or, some people die, actually, from eating gluten. But if you're not gluten sensitive, it's a fine food. But I think more fruits and vegetables and less grain.
So are you sort of in sync with the paleo diet folks?
Yes, I am. I'm not a strict paleo person. I like my cheese too much. and my red wine. I don't want to give those things up. But the reason that diet is really, it's based on science because it's what we used to eat and our bodies have evolved to do best on that wild food. So I'm looking for wild equivalents.
One of the things that's interesting, this book is, I guess I would call it a sort of a combo type of book because you've got not only sort of the history of these plants that you're writing about, and there's all sorts of plants in here, from some of my favorites to some things I know I'm never going to eat. But you also are trying to make it a bit of a how-to book. You have lists of varietals that we could find maybe at farmers markets and at some supermarkets, depending where you
live.
That
was really important to me. I didn't want to write, yet another book about what we shouldn't be eating and what's wrong with our food. So I spent just as much time looking for solutions. And especially in the supermarket and farmers markets and that don't cost more, certainly not supplements. And I found hundreds of varieties that you can get right now, going to the next supermarket, that are far more nutritious than others. And so my book is full of choose this kind of onion and not that one, and this kind of apple and not that one, this kind of lettuce and not that one. And you can bring home 10 times more antioxidants if you know exactly which variety to choose.
What surprised you the most in all this years of research that you did?
I think the extent to which we've bred out these antioxidants. Wild apples, have I'm growing one actually, has 400 times more antioxidants than the Golden Delicious. And it's everything. We've done it to all of our fruits and vegetables. And some people maintain, and there's good evidence for it, that if we had more of these plant compounds, the healthy ones, we would have a much lower risk of obesity, diabetes, cancer, cardiovascular disease, and dementia. Hunter-gatherers did not have those particular problems. They had other problems.
Sure.
They didn't have those.
So if someone were to ask you to write a mantra like Michael Pollan's, have you written one? I'm sure other people besides myself have asked you that.
Actually, you're the first one. It's like the title of my book, Eat on the Wild Side. Find food that most resembles the wild food that we used to eat. And you really won't know without have someone providing a list for you. And that's what I've done.
Joe Robinson's new book is called Eating on the Wild Side, The Missing Link to Optimum Health. Thank you so much for coming in.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. And now, the sound of the day. Our listener Angie sent us that sound. It is the sound of her Saturday morning, a snoring man. And we're going to be quiet a second because in the background you might be able to catch something else. It's her cat purring. Can you hear it, Bernard?
I think I do hear it, unless that's just the power of suggestion.
Or maybe it's like the after snore. A snore and then a purr. We're curious what you are listening to, whether it's the man next to you or the woman next to you or the cat next to you snoring or pugs snore. I hear pug dogs do that. We'd love for you to record 30 seconds of what you hear. Send that sound to us along with the story behind the sound, and the producers say we need sounds in big capital letters. Email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org and include sound of the day in the subject line. And I hope, Angie, that this man that you recorded snoring knows that you recorded him making that sound. Coming up, we're going to talk with Seattle mayoral candidate Joey Gray. We're also going to take a step back from the acquittal of George Zimmerman on Saturday afternoon and talk about what that says about the United States of America, race relations, and attitudes about race. And the Interfaith Amigos join us live in the studio as well. Hope you'll stay with us.
It's 9:59. We're just a minute away from NPR News headlines. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
The domino effects of invasive species.
Gypsy moth. Love oak trees. So where you have heavy infestations of gypsy moth, oak trees tend to diminish after a while, and they're replaced by other trees, like, for instance, maple trees.
Trying to control the invaders before they wreck the neighborhood. I'm Steve Kerwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Environmental news tonight at 10 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Laird Norton Wealth Management, celebrating 75 years of King County Parks by establishing the King County Parks Foundation, devoted to strengthening families and connecting communities for generations to come. Information on contributing at ourparksourfuture.org.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.